Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast with this sound effect and also this one.
Hey, those two go well together.
And how? My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't have a nickname. I don't need one.
Cool.
But it doesn't make my my reviews any less brilliant and insightful.
Wouldn't it be sad if, like, that's what it was? Like, you can't, like, be, like, an insightful film critic until you have, like, a cool critic name? Like, you can't be a superhero whose name is, like, Doug. Like, you've got to actually have a superhero name.
A little bit of zazz to your
name.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert? We call him the Destroyer.
Well, call him the Thumb, I suppose.
That's not a great name.
Although they tried to do that with all of those Avengers movies. It's like, they don't ever say, hey, Captain America, I'm throwing a bad guy at you. It's like, hey, Steve.
Yeah.
It's so, I don't know, it seems so incongruous
all
to me.
All we ask is for a little decorum.
Yeah.
You know? You put on the outfit, he goes to all the trouble. Least he can do is call him Captain America. Anyway, you don't go to Captain America school for 8 years.
Just to be called Steve.
Yeah, come on. Anyway, this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases Dear Evan Hansen, My Little Pony, A New Generation, Sankofa, and Serge. Yeah, those four.
Serge like Serge Gainsborough or Serge like the drink?
Serge like the drink.
Okay.
But it has nothing to do with the drink.
That's too bad.
It is too bad. I would have loved to. I would have watched a whole, like, 8-hour documentary about the history of Surge the drink.
During, like, those 4 months when it was in production. Surge was, dear listeners, I suppose you could call it a competitor to Mountain Dew, like, right around the time energy drinks, like Red Bull, was, like, taking off.
Yeah.
And they pushed it real hard. Mm-hmm. I think it was owned by the Coca-Cola company. And,
It was part of the Rock and Roll Cola Wars, you know, when we couldn't take it anymore.
Ah, of course. But we did start fires about it. Surge, it was bright green. It came in a can that looked like it was exploding with green energy. And they gave out free samples like there was no tomorrow.
Yeah.
I would go down to all of my local shopping centers, and there were always people who were clearly working for peanuts, just handing out cans of this stuff. And I took two cans and as a free sample once.
Okay.
So take one. Okay. Have another. Sure. More soda. I don't drink soda, but whatever. It's free. And I drank a can, and it tastes like not very good Mountain Dew, and Mountain Dew tastes pretty crappy anyway.
Mountain Dew is not great.
So, yeah, it was, like, really acidic. It tasted a lot like the can.
Let's get a baseline here. Is Mountain Dew better or worse than Sierra Mist?
Well, Sierra Mist is a lemon lime, isn't it?
Sure. Is Mountain Dew not...
Lemon limes are typically pretty good. I favor 7-Up above them all, but...
Okay.
I drank the can of Surge. It was okay. I waited a couple hours, and I saw a movie, and then on the way out of the movie, I just said, well, I have this can, and I don't want to keep it in my pants pocket anymore. I'll drink the other can.
Uh-huh.
And it made me so sick.
Well,
that set like nearly vomiting sick when I drank that second can of Surge. I don't know what was in it that my body was disagreeing. Something about the green dye.
Mm.
It was really revolting.
Right. I'm saying I want to see a documentary about that.
And now Surge is gone. Nobody remembers Surge anymore. And thank goodness, you know.
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
Sign of a bygone era. Although we're still living in the energy drink world.
Yeah.
Like, people still drink Monster, and all of that's really awful.
Yeah. Anyway, we review movies. So, this week we're reviewing the new releases. We already did that.
You said the new releases.
We already did that.
And you know what movie makes you feel like you're drinking an energy drink is Dear Evan Hansen.
Jesus Christ. I was filled with rage. I don't know about energy. I don't know if energy is the word I would use. Dear Evan Hansen.
Dear Evan Hansen is, God, sure is. There's blood in the water with Dear Evan Hansen. It's attracting the sharks. Dear Evan Hansen is a new film. It's based on a hit Broadway show.
Tony Award winning Broadway show from about 5 years ago.
Thereabouts.
A bunch of Tonys. And just as a baseline, because I know a lot of people are Broadway stans. You know, they really know a lot about Broadway. They follow Broadway. I have a lot of respect. For Broadway, but I don't follow it. I live nowhere near it.
Yeah, we can't go see shows on Broadway unless we fly across the country. Yeah,
and even when those shows do end up sort of traveling around, it's expensive. And I've gone to like
Hamilton is at the Pantages here in Hollywood.
I saw Hamilton at the Pantages, which was a gift from my mother for like Christmas. She got us tickets, and I got to see Book of Mormon at the Pantages as well. But I haven't been to a Broadway show since probably 2004, 2005, because I don't get to go to New York very often.
Yeah.
And I've seen some stuff that has become movies. I have heard some soundtracks here or there, but Dear Evan Hansen just completely passed me by. Mm. I assumed, since it was so popular, since it won so many awards, that it must be pretty good. But that's all I really knew. And I don't think I was even consciously aware of like what the plot was until shortly before this movie came out. Mm. And I was like, what?
Well, the plot is very similar to that of the Bobcat Goldthwait film, World's Greatest Dad.
Which is a great movie.
It is quite good. And that one stars Robin Williams as a father whose son is just a horrible person that he has a lot of trouble raising.
Yeah.
He's
like, toxic in every way. Nobody likes him. He contributes
girls. Yeah,
he contributes nothing really positive to the community. He's borderline emotionally abusive to his dad. Mm. And his son ends up dying while attempting autoerotic asphyxiation. You can look it up. But when
Robin Williams discovers his son, he's heartbroken, but
he wants to preserve his son's dignity.
Yeah, in order to sort of, you know, make sure, that his son isn't remembered for his final act. He wrote a note, and the note was so well written, in fact, that it started catching on attention in the broader community. It was being circulated online and eventually published, and the dead son started being held up as this sort of unseen sufferer, this young symbol of all of teen angst that was going unrecognized.
And now he's being remembered as someone who actually was a very beautiful, misunderstood soul, and that's actually not who he was at all.
It's a
dark comedy, though. Like, it's not supposed to be inspirational and sweet. It's actually a very bitter but very insightful film about the way that people like to turn other people's deaths into something that's about them.
Yeah, like a cause of theirs. Yeah. And that is a huge part of Dear Evan Hansen as well.
Yeah.
Evan Hansen, the title character, is a young, socially awkward a teenager. He's played by the star from Broadway,
Ben Platt.
Ben Platt.
And he's dealing with a lot of mental health issues, certainly depression, certainly probably generalized anxiety disorder.
He's taking unspecified meds for some sort of mood disorder.
Yeah.
And he has been assigned by his mother, who's played by Julianne Moore, as a shrink, given the assignment.
He has a psychologist. We never see the psychologist, but he has a psychologist who has given him an assignment to write a letter to himself every day.
So he starts letters to himself. Dear Evan Hansen, my day isn't going so well. Like, he's kind of having a conversation with himself so he can kind of suss out his moods a little bit more cleanly.
The structure is actually, today is going to be a great day, but he has trouble sort of lingering on that thought, and the letters tend to turn darker whether he likes it or not. But in any case, it's the first day back at school, and he's
broken his wrist on an accident. He fell out of a tree recently, so he's a big cast on his wrist.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like the school year is going to be any better. People are ignoring him or are mean to him. Over the course of the day, he ends up interacting with another young man in his grade named Connor, who is also a pariah, who is also seen as having severe mental health issues. And while they are interacting in a library, and Connor is actually making an attempt to befriend Evan Hansen and actually hey, we seem to both be loners. Can we talk? I feel bad about how we interacted earlier. Let me sign your cast, that kind of thing. It seems like a real attempt to reach out.
It seems sort of ironic to me.
It's perhaps.
Look, you're friendless as well. I'm going to sign your cast ironically. So he signs his cast.
For me, I saw it as a genuine attempt to reach out. The reason why is because Evan Hansen, for whatever reason, had decided to print out The letter that he wrote to himself?
He printed out one of the letters.
Which is completely unnecessary. You could totally email that to your psychologist.
In the school library, so it's a shared printer. Connor finds the letter.
And because the letter specifically mentions Connor's sister, whom Evan Hansen has a crush on, Connor happens to look at the letter, which is not long, and thinks to himself, Evan Hansen is manipulating me or being creepy, and he's making fun of me, or he only wants to use me to get to my sister. And he has, a big outpouring of rage, and he vanishes, and Evan Hansen
Taking
the letter with him. Evan Hansen spends a couple of days worrying how this is going to affect him. Is Connor going to, show the internet, the letter to everyone at school? That kind of thing. And then a couple of days later, he is asked to the principal's office, where Evan Hansen's parents, played by Amy Adams and Danny Pino,
So we have Julianne Moore mom and
Amy Adams mom.
That feels like some sort of treaty has been violated.
You can't have both.
You're not allowed to have both. You can have one or the other.
Yeah. But they inform him that Connor has ended his own life. And what they think is the suicide note is
the Dear Evan Hansen.
Is the Dear Evan Hansen. And they assume that Connor and Evan Hansen have been friends, and because their son was emotionally distant and not talking to them, they simply didn't know about it. So they assume this is the case. Evan Hansen rather weakly tries to deny it, but they're so sad he can't quite bring himself to say the words. And so they invite him over to dinner to sort of just tell me what you knew about our son, because we didn't get to know him very well, and obviously we're all very distraught. And at that point, it goes from a tragedy to something that is genuinely fucked up.
Well, this is the moment where he decides to agree with them that this letter that he wrote to himself really was Connor's suicide note.
And not correct them and let them have whatever they like. Your son had a friend. That's nice. But to start piling on detail and manipulation.
Well, they keep asking him and pressing him, he is not in a position, he doesn't have the wherewithal to just come out and say the truth. He's trying to appease them in that moment. This is a musical. He's had several songs along the way, and the songs are actually, I think, very heart-wrenching. They're actually kind of honest musical numbers.
They're certainly trying to be, trying to be.
That Ben Platt is delivering very well. He's performed this on Broadway, and now he's performing it again on film, and I feel like the songs themselves, in a vacuum, are actually staged really well. But just like in World's Greatest Dad, the letter starts proliferating, and then Evan Hansen decides to write more letters.
Yeah.
I'm going to fake an
ongoing email conversation between the both of us. And
the emails are dated. I don't know how you do that.
He has a friend who knows computers, basically. Yeah. And the whole thing, there's this whole musical number where he's trying to write these letters between Connor and himself and backdate them, which, by the way, has a whole bunch of bits where, his friend keeps trying to, eroticize their relationship. Yeah. And so he has to keep insisting, but I'm not gay. And that feels like a weird digression that we really did not need and is not funny.
They keep on stressing that the parents keep inviting Evan Hansen over because they assumed that he and Connor were lovers. The parents never say that.
A lot of the other students say,
they assume that Evan Hansen and Connor were boyfriends.
I wish they'd come out and said that rather than left it, it's something that could also not take away with relative ease.
And all of these letters, the rest of the world is just eating up. They love this. They start foundations, and Connor's name is really, really troubled, and he was suffering silently, so let's collect money and help others in need. And just like in World's Greatest Dad, this poor, tortured young man is now being used as a feel-good tool for the community.
Yeah.
And that is ethically dodgy on everyone's part. And Evan Hansen is the one who's perpetuating all of this.
Yeah, it's
the he also... He is... the sister is played by Caitlin Deaver from Booksmart.
Yeah.
She's great. I love her. And... she does not have rosy memories of Connor. In fact,
Connor was essentially abusive to her.
Yeah, Connor.
She talks about being trapped in her bedroom while he was banging on the door, threatening to kill her.
He was abusive. He manipulated her. She tells a story about how when she was 12, he called her and he was like strung out on drugs downtown and he just wanted money. So she gave him some money.
She had 12 to take a bus and go downtown.
So she doesn't have any good memories of her brother. And so this new figure that Evan Hansen is selling to the world that he's making up about this guy he didn't know.
Yeah, he sings an entire song to her about how your brother really loved you. He noticed all of these things about you, which actually Evan Hansen noticed because he has a romantic crush on her.
Oh.
And that gets really fucking weird. Like, no, your brother really loved you, but he loved you in the way that I romantically love you. Mm. And I'm trying to erase your actual memory of abuse and replace it with a rosy memory, which actually isn't necessarily going to help you deal with your abusive past, but it will help me get closer to you. Mm. So when they start dating, it's evil.
And the, you know what? I would be okay with this if the film acknowledged its own darkness.
I would too.
But it doesn't. It treats, like Evan Hansen, it says, the film declares, is making mistakes. He's making bad decisions. It's not condoning what he's doing. But it's not rolling with how far this has already gone, the way World's Greatest Dad did.
The movie is so insistent on being sympathetic with everyone that it has no moral compass whatsoever. And well, I think that's something that the movie lacks is principles. That's the thing that struck World's Greatest Dad is a very mean movie about really mean things, but its tone and its perception, its principles, its viewpoint is clear.
Yeah.
The viewpoint of Dear Evan Hansen is not clear because I get the impression that we're supposed to sympathize with Evan Hansen and we find out more about him in ways that are specifically designed to make him more sympathetic and to make us understand what he's going through. And I get that on one level, I am sympathetic with his motivations.
Mm.
I'm not sympathetic with what he does, which is a prolonged series of conscious decisions to manipulate for his own end. Initially, fine, I can understand the social awkwardness involved and you made a bad call. Over the course of the film, the decisions he makes escalates and make him, regardless of his motivations, into an emotional abuser. And that is something that is really grotesque, that the movie never really engages with. Even when the shit hits the fan, as it inevitably must, he gets off pretty fucking light.
He gets off super... Yeah, he is not confronted in a satisfying way. If he weren't confronted... And he realized that he kind of liked manipulating people and became kind of an evil person.
That
would have been an interesting arc.
Yeah.
Not necessarily an uplifting or exciting one, but, an arc. Evan Hansen has that moment where he realizes what he's done is wrong, but all he does is sort of, like, drift off to the side and have a I'm alone again song rather than... I've done some pretty ethically bad things.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, one of the things that he does, and it's very few things, to try to sort of redeem himself, involves violating the sanctity of privacy in psychotherapy. Well, I don't want to go into great detail, but he shares something that is from therapy.
Okay.
That he shouldn't have been privy to, and certainly no one else should, because it's... a group of people who would be in therapy to get... It doesn't work.
The emotional honesty comes in little fits in this movie. You can tell that they're trying to put its heart in the right place. And
I'm sure everyone was very well-intentioned. I just don't think they necessarily knew how to put it together.
And I feel like on stage, a lot of the darkness might read a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. There are also numbers that are apparently missing here, which maybe add more context, maybe make it work more effectively. I also am willing to accept that in theater... the live theatrical experience, there's something a little bit more... the audience is expected to engage its imagination even more in some respects in theater. Because there's a certain immediacy, but there's also a certain abstraction. We can't see that this is actually high school. We know it's fake.
They're on a set.
Yeah. So as a result, I think there is often a willingness to go along with the ride, whatever it is, that doesn't always come across in cinema, because in cinema, so many other... artisans can do that work for you, and as a result we expect movies to sort of guide us to where we need to go rather than expect us to take that journey ourselves. And so I acknowledge that Dear Evan Hansen is something that may work better on stage, may very well capture this tone. Stephen Chbosky, who directed this, he tends to make movies about teens in emotional crisis. His film, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, is a film that I have a few issues with, but is mostly a very tender and earnest motion picture, and I mostly really appreciate it.
He also wrote the novel on which it's based.
Also wrote that novel, he's so a novelist he's very well, close to it.
So he, yeah, here he seems to put himself in the mind of a teenager who is in emotional dire straits and is going to make bad decisions in that space.
Here I think
is a fine place to occupy.
I think it is. I think it isn't though. I think his earnestness with this, the sort of like I'm just going to put everything, every song, every act here at face value and put all of my heart and soul into Evan Hansen's journey. Even at the sacrifice of everyone else's journey, many of whom are more sympathetic or are going through greater tragedies, including the person who killed themselves.
Yeah, we don't get to know his story.
We don't get to know his story. His story is permanently usurped by Evan Hansen. His story is warped by Evan Hansen to fit his needs or what he thinks other people need to hear. And in the end, his story is never properly told. And in when all is said and done, when people look back at this event that happened, no one's going to say, oh, poor Connor. They're going to talk about what Evan Hansen did.
Yeah.
His life has been completely hijacked, and so has his death, by someone who had absolutely no business being there in the first place.
There's
a song where he actually appears as kind of like a ghost or whatever, and it's the way that they handle it is so crass. Well, it really pissed me off,
In that moment, that's meant to be crass, but by the time we get to the end, Connor's story has been erased, and that's really, really reprehensible.
Yeah. I know a lot of people who
said... Did you ever see Love, Simon?
I did. I didn't see it when it first came out, but I did eventually. Okay, it's quite good.
It's a very sweet film. It's my only issue is that Simon himself is like a blandest toast kind of character. Like, he doesn't have a lot of texture. But near the end of that movie...
A lie is revealed as well, yeah.
Well, he's essentially blackmailed by a classmate, because he's in the closet, and he hasn't told his family yet, and he doesn't know how to handle that, and this is the modern world. It's not like people will care a great deal if he comes out, but it's his story to tell. And
it depends on your community as well. Let's be fair, but like in that particular case, they're openly gay kids in their high school, and it's not a big deal.
Many out kids at the school, But when this other student finds out and blackmails him and then does something really horrible with that information, he confronts that kid and he says, it doesn't matter. This was my story. I got to tell this. And I was waiting for that moment with Connor in this movie.
Yeah.
Connor gets to tell his story at some point.
Wouldn't that have been nice?
For a
brief second, they give you the impression that he does, but he doesn't really. Mm. It's not like... like we actually get Connor's story. Connor is erased. Connor is deprioritized in this narrative. And that's something that is, frankly, fucked up. I know a lot of people who... this movie, screened for critics and had some festivals. And critics have been very, very hard on it. And I think with cause. I think it is a movie that is very, very painful to watch because its sympathy is wildly misplaced.
Yeah,
but a lot of people have seen it now, and the audience score on like Rotten Tomatoes is really high, and some people are responding to it very, very well. And I've had some people respond to like my tweet about it, saying like, "Oh, you have no soul," and and you know what? And you're entitled to that thought, and that's fine. But for me, this general attitude that I've seen, the defense of the movie is that we're not sympathetic enough with Evan Hansen. Mm. I can be sympathetic with why people do monstrous things while still condemning the things they do.
And the world's greatest dad is an example of that.
A great example of that.
The father does really unethical things and is actually, for a lot of the movie, kind of bemused that he's getting away with it.
Yeah.
But he understands that he's getting away with something.
Yeah, there's always this thought, one day this lie will be revealed and, I'll be screwed. And so,
but then, another ship comes in or another opportunity presents itself, so he keeps writing it.
And he was, so that's a great movie, but like... Here, again, the sympathy for Evan Hansen, and I don't think Ben Platt is particularly good here. A lot of being made is the fact that he's too old for the role. He's
27.
A lot of actors are too old to play teenagers and still do. For me, the issue isn't he's 27. For me, the issue is he looks older than the other people playing in his age bracket. most of whom are not in the right age bracket either way. But regardless, he looks out of place.
Caitlin Dever is also in her 20s.
Yeah, but she doesn't look out of place. And I feel like Ben Platt kind of does.
I feel like Connor looks even older than he does.
I agree. But he comes out of the picture very quickly.
That Ben Platt looks older wasn't an issue for me at all. I grew up on Beverly Hills 90210 back in the 90s, and they were all in their 30s.
The one thing for me that made it, that his age fucked up a moment, there's a moment where he's having a really touching moment with his mom, played by Julianne Moore, and she's like really, she works constantly. She works as a nurse. She's a single mom. She's out of his life. Excuse me. Hiccup a lot. And she finally has a very sweet song about just how difficult it is to be a single mom, knowing that you will screw up, knowing that there's so many things that can and will go wrong no matter how hard you try. And at the end, when he moves to hug her, his face is like a little too close to hers, and I thought they were going to kiss. Like, I was like, because he looks like more in her age bracket than he does as a teenager, and that was weird. So there was a brief moment where the scene reads wrong because he looks too old.
I don't appreciate, and I haven't seen the whole film, but I've seen enough of it to know I don't want to see any more, but when Chris Columbus made Rent...
That was a movie I wanted to bring up, actually.
He insisted on bringing the original cast back for Rent, and that movie came out in, what, 2005?
Yeah, about 15 years after Rent premiered on Broadway, yeah.
Rent, yeah, is very much a time capsule of the 1990s.
Yes.
And it should have been set in the 90s. I think they set it in modern day. I think it was in post 9/11.
Did they actually set it?
York.
Oh, no. I don't remember that. I only saw it the once.
Yeah, it is very much a time capsule, and...
Yeah.
As such, you're going to need people who are a very specific age at a very specific time.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily this thing he's doing where I need to preserve the purity of the Broadway
cast.
Experience in a cinema experience. As such, we have most of the original cast now 10 years older than they were when they debuted on Broadway.
Most of them read to be about 40, which... Mm. Wouldn't be so bad if the musical wasn't very specifically about people in their early 20s.
It's about people in their early 20s trying to succeed in the arts in New York when they have no money. And,
yeah.
And that's a very specific time capsule in people's lives.
There's only one member of the cast, the main cast, who they change and they recast with Rosario Dawson, who looks so much younger than everyone else that it's a distraction. She's very good in it, by the way, but she looks very much younger than everyone else.
So the casting of Ben Platt was, in one way, kind of logical because he was very, very much acclaimed on Broadway playing this role.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and he sings well.
Sure, he plays the parts well.
But you know, he's also putting on that stage performance where he's playing really big to these film actors like Julianne Moore and Amy Adams are. They've done stage work, but they're also used to performing for a camera where the audience is right there next to you.
Ben Platt is playing to the back of the theater, and the camera is right in your fucking face. You don't need to do that.
His age starts to read because he's so much, for lack of a better term, hammier than everybody else.
Yeah.
He's giving a good stage performance on film, and it feels really off.
And again, if everyone was giving that performance, you look at the way that acting styles have evolved, if this exact type of performance, the movie wouldn't have gotten made, but let's say this exact type of performance was in a musical from the 50s, it would read fine.
Yeah, absolutely, because everyone would be there.
Just like Gene Kelly, well, maybe not just like, but it would be the same type of vibe as a Gene Kelly or whatever, and it would just be fine. It's a somewhat stagier performance, but it's a good performance. But he's really out of place here. And I almost wish he could have leaned into that even more because he's so out of place and that represents his isolation. You could have done that, but they never really expressed that with any kind of confidence. I find this movie so frustrating. It made me so angry to watch this much emotional hardship being committed by a character we're ostensibly supposed to have sympathy for, and almost everything he does after maybe the 20-minute mark is something that I have no sympathy for. And I get that movies don't always have to have positive heroes. You can have an anti-hero or even a villain as a protagonist, but at the same time, this movie plays it as though I'm supposed to be really forgiving of him. And you lost me because of the way you played the story. You lost that.
And now you can't get that back.
I'm sympathetic for his plight, but I'm more sympathetic to his victims.
I'm not I'm not so morally outraged by this movie because I think it's fine to tell a morally outrageous story.
In theory, yes.
And I think there's a great deal of darkness in this story that could have made for quite a good telling.
But I do like
that along the way we're getting some pretty emotionally earnest songs about the teen experience, and I think some of the songs are really quite good. And it just whittles it all down its leg because it is not addressing the darkness.
Yeah.
And falls into this kind of sappy sentimentality that it doesn't earn.
Yeah.
From a lead character who's given a really oddball performance when put next to all of his peers. And then, yeah, at the end of it, it doesn't really commit to any kind of moral. It's just sort of, and he feels bad about it. And that's kind of where we leave it. He doesn't pay a price.
Not a meaningful price anyway. Nothing that counts.
He does something that like sort of feels meaningful to him, and I would have loved for that to have blown up in his face at the end, where he does something that he feels really meaningful. He's going to make this grand gesture, and the parents say no.
And then the sister says,
"No, you are not helping.
You forfeit your right." To insinuate yourself into this situation at all, even if you think you're doing something positive.
Like if it had finally called him on it, then it would have been fine. But yeah,
I wish someone had. He deserved someone to sit him down, because even like because again, the lie has to be revealed. That's the way the structure of the story is. Man, everyone's just so like eager to move on and not suffer anymore that nobody, and I mean nobody, actually takes him to task for his shit.
Yeah.
And I think the movie really would have benefited from a banger of a song from like one of the parents or even the principal
one character played by Amand Stenberg in a supporting role who's the one who sort of like figures out like what was going on.
She starts to figure it out. She actually has one of my favorite songs because she talks about she's like the most popular girl in school and she's like the school class president, and she's got straight A's, and everyone thinks she's got all her shit together, but actually she's suffering from many of the same mental health issues as Evan Hansen, and she has a good song about suffering silently. I actually really like that song.
I had kind of hoped that she would have been the one, that character, to call out Evan Hansen.
And then she actually forfeits the right to any sort of moral authority as well, because she does something pretty fucking rancid by the end of the movie, for no great reason.
Or if everybody realized that it was a lie and everything was really rancid and they all decide to roll with it anyway, just kind of showing this depravity, the way we're going to exploit the death of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how you implied what the story was going to be about at the start?
Mm-hmm.
That would have been good too. Doesn't do any of that. I agree with you. I'm going to repeat your word. It's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It's frustrating because it's opening all these doors and not going through any of them.
No, not a meaningful way. It's so eager to just sympathize and forgive everybody that it's ignoring many of the issues that are right there. Yes. Listen, I suffer from mental health issues. I've talked about it a lot. Mental health issues deserve our sympathy. Deserve to be discussed.
Mm-hmm.
I also think they deserve to be discussed well.
Yeah.
By people who have, and again, I'm sure Stephen Chbosky has. I mean, he's dealt with this better in other movies. But that doesn't mean every single time is going to be equal. It doesn't mean that every single earnest attempt, and I'm sure most, if not everyone involved with this, was earnestly trying to accomplish something here. Mm. It doesn't mean they succeeded. And what ultimately came across here is a movie that is more creepy than anything else. And that doesn't help. I don't think it's especially responsible the way that this movie turned out and its depiction of mental health and its depiction of, even just the whole, like, you know, rallying behind someone's meaningful statements about the untimely death of someone who took their own lives. Mm. When we know all of that is based on a lie, all of these like genuine human connections people are being made dishonestly.
Mm.
What are we supposed to take away from that? What are we supposed to do with that? His dishonesty meant more to people than the actual truth of this teenager killing themselves?
That would have been a message. That could have been interesting. But again, that's not something they commit to.
The movie just does that and says, like, oh, it's so beautiful. No, actually, it's weirdly hypocritical. And, yeah, I'm so aggravated by this movie. I was mad at it.
I'm wondering if Bobcat Goldthwait has, like, an actionable case. Because it's a very similar story to his film, World's Greatest Dad.
Very similar.
And did you notice the name of
the high school team? So basically,
it's called the Bobcats.
And it's not subtle. Like, we see it big in the background. People say, "Go Bobcats." And again, this play came out after World's Greatest Dad premiered. World's Greatest Dad was not a big film. It should have been. It's a really excellent motion picture. But
it was big on the indie circuit.
It was pretty big on the indie circuit, but it didn't get a lot of awards attention, which is, again, a shame. I think it's actually one of Robin Williams' best performances. About 5-ish years later, this play comes out, and it's pretty similar, and that's not a problem in and of itself. But I remember thinking to myself, okay, well, they're surely not going to, like, lean into this and call attention to it, and then they say the word Bobcats 20 times in the first 20 minutes.
the director.
Jesus Christ. So either
Goldthwaite's.
Like, you'd think at the very least someone would have said, okay, we need to change the name of the school team at least. That's a bit much.
A little on the nose.
It's really weird. So I don't know. I don't know how that works. I do know that, like, there have been, and again, I'm not saying anyone should. I don't know the legal parameters here. But you may recall, what was that movie with Guy Pearce that was like, it was like Escape from New York, but in space?
Lockdown.
Guy Pearce played a guy who was recruited to rescue, I think it was like the president's daughter who had been like kidnapped and was in like an orbiting space station prison. And structurally, it's exactly the same as Escape from New York, just in a different place. And I didn't think anything would come of this, but John Carpenter sued, and he won.
He won because the story was too similar.
Yeah, so people can be pretty cavalier about, like, stealing stuff and, like, following structural similarities. There is a line you can cross. I don't know if this does it, but there is a line. Because probably it's okay because it's a teenager who did it and not, like, the kid's dad. That's probably big enough that it's probably okay. But, like, it's still... And again, I don't know. Maybe they didn't see it. Maybe it is a total coincidence. Sometimes people just have good ideas at the same time, but...
Bob Goldthwaite is constantly touring. He's on stage a lot. He's doing a really interesting project right now with Dana Gould, another excellent comedian. And the two of them do stand up together on the stage at the same time, and they kind of riff on each other's material. Which I don't think I'd seen any other, like, comedic pairs do that before.
I mean, the Sklar brothers, kind of, but, well, like, they've been always been a unit.
Weren't a duo,
Yeah.
Like, you know, Abbott and Costello, of course, goes back to ancient times, but I mean, independent stand-up comedians just sort of doing a bit, together. That isn't like an improv game or something. I think that's really fascinating, and I'd love to get a ticket to his tour because I know he's got something to say about Dear Evan Hansen.
Oh yeah,
and I want to hear Bob Goldthwaite's words on Dear Evan Hansen.
I'd be very very curious. But in any case,
in conclusion,
yeah, and it's not even the only bad movie musical that came out this week, because we also have and we're going to talk a bit about my history with it. We also have My Little Pony: A New Generation, which is a new feature film. It was supposed to come out in theaters. They decided to pull it because of COVID, and then Netflix swooped in, and they released it this weekend. This is a new... Technically, it is a sequel, like, takes place generations later, after the long-running, very popular 2D animated My Little Pony: Friendship is Magic, which has its spin-off with Equestria Girls, and it's a big cultural touchstone.
The characters from Friendship is Magic are extinct.
They're dead.
They're all dead. Yeah,
which makes you wonder how'd they die. Like, it's not like they died like stopping a bad guy or something. That's not really what they would do. But it just makes you think. It's just like, yeah. What was Twilight Sparkle's final moment like? How did she go?
These are your magical talking horses. I didn't really want to think about that. Like, one of the, like, there's unicorns and pegasuses and
Earth ponies. Which, they can't just call them pony because they're all ponies.
Chained to the surly bounds of Earth by the harsh mistress of gravity.
Earth ponies are ponies. Pegasuses are ponies with wings. And then unicorns are ponies
with a
spike on their head, and only and Pegasus can fly. Unicorns can use magic, and there is a very rare type of pony called an alicorn, which is both a unicorn and a pegasus. They can fly and use magic, but there's only a few of those. My Little Pony,
aren't unicorns immortal in most fantasy stories?
Well, not in this one, but what are immortal in My Little Pony is actually several characters who do not show up in this movie, which is kind of weird. The whole selling this as a sequel makes this whole thing fucking weird, and I want to talk about why.
It's a new generation. It's like Star Trek. They're just skipping ahead a generation.
Not the worst idea in the world. You want to keep it in that world, but you want to like tell new stories and new characters. Yeah. That in and of itself is not a problem. Real, real fast. My Little Pony is a cartoon series that was based on... It was basically created to sell toys in the 80s.
It's another Hasbro.
The toys are little ponies. They're plastic ponies, and they have like lifelike hair that you can brush. Mm. And they have different personalities. They have these cutie marks that like give them different personalities and interests. And
Differing butt tattoos.
Basically, they're butt tattoos.
The original ponies... were essentially the same mold. They all looked very similar.
There was a few variations, but mostly the same.
And like a lot of cartoons in the 1980s, didn't have a lot of personality, and it existed to sell toys.
No, it was...
But because it existed to sell toys, that branding, that insidious branding, got into an entire generation of kids.
Yeah.
And we've carried the brand with us ever since.
Now, however, what's worth noting is that sometimes the persistence of a brand... can be arguably a good thing, because although the original 1980s My Little Pony TV show and movie, which were not particularly good, when they decided to bring them back...
I've seen all of these, but I've seen all the movies.
Yeah, yeah. But
even the ones from the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. They're not good.
No.
But the when they decided to reboot them, the people who were put in charge of rebooting this as an animated series actually... cared about it and had some ambitions. And they kind of did, in a weird way, what George Lucas did with Star Wars, which is, I'm going to make the show that I imagined that I had while I was watching this inferior other show that excited my imagination but didn't actually give me what I wanted.
When you're a little kid, you're watching this show and it feels fantastic.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take you too many years to realize that what you were watching was not good.
Yeah.
So when you become an adult, you make the good version.
Yeah.
And that was in your head when you were a little kid.
And that's happened with several intellectual properties lately. The Netflix animated She-Ra is a good example, or their Voltron as well. Those shows have problems, but they're leaps and bounds artistically, from a storytelling perspective, ahead of the original. And that was true with My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, which is a good show. I fell out of it after a while because, like all shows, it runs out of steam. Mm. But the initial few seasons of that show were this incredibly wholesome but entertaining program that imagined a utopian world and made that kind of interesting. I was thinking about... We have a show on our Patreon called All Our Yesterdays, where we review every single episode of Star Trek. And we're in the middle of the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation. And one of the guidelines that Gene Roddenberry created for Star Trek The Next Generation for his writing staff was there can be no interpersonal conflict between the crew.
They have to work together to solve problems.
You watch like the documentaries of the writing staff, and they're like, how the hell do we do that?
You get creative.
That's the deal. Yeah. You have to get creative. You're telling a story about a utopian society. You cannot have bullshit petty rivalries. People are supposed to be beyond that. But there does still need to be a way to tell an entertaining story within that framework. And if you can keep that framework consistent, your utopia becomes something people are willing to aspire to. And if you can find a way to tell interesting stories within that system, you can create something that is not only entertaining, but different and incredibly inspirational. And I think that it's a show for little kids, of course, but not every little kid's show is able to pull this off. My Little Pony Friendship is Magic managed to tell funny stories about a world in which, yeah, there are problems, but it's all stuff that it's about personal growth. We can all do a little better.
As the title imply, were about
friendship.
About the relationships between the characters and how good things feel between them.
Yeah, how can we be better friends? How can we be better listeners? And I think they did an excellent job in proving that very simple idea can be the basis for a lot of really, really great stories. But they're not typical stories in a lot of ways. You do have to do something very, very different. So you have this series that has grown and expanded and sold a ton of merchandise and built up a huge fan base based upon, and I see why it has this almost like Trekkie kind of fan base, because it's utopian. It's something that we can aspire to. We can all aspire to be more like this. And then when we're going to reboot it with this new movie, My Little Pony, A New Generation, what's the first thing they do? They add racism. It's generations later. Now the Earth ponies hate the unicorns and the Pegasuses. The Pegasuses hate the unicorns and the Earth ponies and vice and all around.
Yeah, the three worlds have become fractured off, and they've given into these racist indoctrinations where they're in each individual town being taught to fear and hate the others that they never interact with.
And again, this isn't like Star Wars, where like the fundamental basis is that fascism always comes back and we always have to fight it. This is taking, hey, that utopia did not work. Fell apart, and we will not engage with how that happened. At all. It's just eventually people started being shitty and things got really racist and terrible, and that's the foundation for this new one. I think that is a bad place to start.
I think this is a post-Trump movie.
It very much is.
I think this is about looking at the country and seeing fascism sort of rise. These fascist ideas were always kind of a part of the fabric of this, and this is a film about how that utopia you thought, it wasn't as idealistic as you thought, and there was actually some insidious things happening underneath all of this.
And I'm not sure...
And there were fascists lurking among the ponies, including a Muammar Gaddafi pony in this movie.
That's really fucking weird. I'm just telling... Listen, I'm not saying you can't tell that story, but when you go from this thing that very much, like, pulled away from this idea of personal conflict and created something to aspire to, and instead you make it like, no, they're just as shitty as everyone else, you're actually... You might be saying something, but you're also robbing it of a lot of its power because it was above that.
I think it is a fine story about prejudice, though, for little kids.
I think it's overly simplified even for little kids, but it is. I think it is also... the message is very clearly positive. I just think it's not told very well.
I think it's told just fine, and I'm not a brony. I've seen the movies, I just
can appreciate the show.
I saw a commentary track for the one of the Equestria Girls feature films,
Rainbow Rocks, which is on our Patreon.
Takes place in a parallel universe where the ponies are people, but also when they rock really hard, they turn into partial ponies, which is very bizarre.
It's a documentary. What happens.
Yeah, when you throw a guitar at a pony, they turn into a person.
Sure. Do not try that at home.
No, please don't. We open up in Maritime Bay, but it's Maritime Bay. Isn't that cute? There's a lot of horse puns.
A lot of horse puns.
And
there's a marquee for a Terminator movie, except it's called Judgment Nay.
Judgment Nay.
Yeah. Get it?
I'm going to have to look up the names of these characters.
You're looking for the Vanessa Hudgens pony. He's named Sunny Star
Scout.
We
start in the Earth pony world, and it's a very restrictive society they live in, because they live, their entire society is based on fear.
Yeah.
They're afraid of unicorns and pegasuses that they've never interacted with, but there's all these conspiracy posters around town. Mm. It's weirdly evocative of like Elders of Zion shit. Like
it goes beyond even where we are now in America and goes like to like and, something and, like, really, really
the,
twisted.
The economy
I'm granted
is,
we're
like,
not that far,
the,
but like
the entertainment is all based on hating other ponies. Yeah. The economy is driven by selling products that protect you from other ponies.
Yeah.
And again,
these are things that are around, but when you put them all like together in this one thing, it's like really weird.
What I appreciate, because this is, this is using, the pony language to sort of sell, kind of racist connections to gun sales and the way a lot of racial stereotypes is still a big part of our entertainment.
Mm. Yeah.
This is actually giving very wholesome ideas and ways to look at the world to a younger audience.
Well, that's something I will say is I think maybe the best thing about this movie is the way that it is actually trying to encourage kids to question propaganda.
Yeah.
If you're being told to hate something, you should question that. That's the best part of this movie. I don't think the story is told very well, but I think the message is actually quite good, and I have no real issue with it.
We also have an ACAB moment, because we have James Marsden plays Hitch Trailblazer.
Oh yeah,
he's the Ponytown sheriff.
Yeah, and Ponytown has no mayor or king or any sort of person in charge. And eventually, we realize
Mayor Humdinger from Paw Patrol.
We don't have that. We just the general implication over the course of the film is that the sheriff is basically in charge, which is weird because he's the same age as Sonny Star Scout, so he's probably like in his mid 20s, which seems a little young to be sheriff.
They seem to be teens, yeah, but
they're still pretty young to be in charge.
Look, they're magic ponies. We don't care.
I know. Look, you're making me ask the questions, but that's all I'm saying. Anyway.
But when a curious unicorn with no agenda, just sort of is wandering about, wanders into the town, kind of randomly one day, and this is Izzy Moonbow, and Izzy Moonbow is naive and idealistic and just wants to make friends with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But is immediately attacked by the Earth Ponies with their slime-flinging machines.
Yeah, they immediately say, she's going to kill us all, we have to kill her first, kill. Sonny, who was raised by a dad who actually, like, believed that...
A little more open-minded.
Well, he's actually like, no, actually I've done research, and it turns out that all ponies can, and indeed have, lived together in harmony, and other ponies are just like, we don't trust you. You don't understand fear the way we do. And then he dies between flashbacks, which is fucked up. That's a bad way to go. But Sonny believes that all this propaganda is bullshit and we can live in harmony with the other ponies. So when a unicorn shows up, she's super excited because we can be friends. And everyone else is like, must kill. Eventually they go on the run because Hitch has to run after them. And Hitch leaves his deputy...
This is played by Ken Jeong.
Yep, Deputy Sprout. He doesn't leave him in charge. He says, just try to keep people from being too scared while I'm gone. And within a day, Sprout has decided...
he's going to be a fascist ruler.
Everyone goes to Sprout and says, hey, we're really scared about unicorns. And Sprout goes up and is like, wait a minute. Maybe you should be scared. What if they're coming to kill us all? What if they're teaming up with the Pegasuses? And what if they're leading a caravan right here to Maritime? it's on the notes. And the only good, this is actually kind of fucked up, the only good song in this movie is the fascist song. Mm. It's the song about basically being an angry mob. And it's clearly articulated that this is stupid people being stupid. But it's also, like, the song that has the most energy and the most personality and the funniest lyrics.
It's the only one that's a little different. The others are kind of just generic pop ballads.
Like, we're ponies and we're dressing up.
Yeah, we're going to dress up like unicorns because we're going to disguise ourselves.
Yeah, it's not a great song.
And it's a Gulliver's Travels. At first, they go to Pegasus Kingdom. And
turns out that the Pegasuses can't fly.
They don't have magic anymore. It turns out there's no more magic in Pony World. Because unicorns don't have magic because of the friendship schism. The great friendship schism of 688 AP. And
after Pony?
After
Pony. We're all Pony.
What was the main pony from Friendship is Magic?
After Twilight Sparkle.
After
ATS.
ATS. After Twilight Sparkle. We've also learned that they're very much like in Gulliver's Travels, they're each pony tribe is devoted to some different facet. The Pegasi are devoted to
celebrity
and aesthetics.
Yeah.
Then they go to
the unicorns,
and they've devoted themselves to superstition.
They're actually afraid of magic now that they don't have it.
The one scene that I really loved was when they go to the pony bar.
Really? This is the scene that you love.
And there's, I don't know why, but the sight of the pony beatniks really made me giggle. And I really, really wanted one of them to just launch into howl. Like with a bongo. I saw the best ponies of my generation destroyed by magic, starring hysterical. Would have been great. And they end up having, and I was also really hoping that they'd have a drinking contest, but because it's just tea.
Right.
They don't drink booze in Pony World.
Listen, in some respects, this is not a particularly bad movie. Again, the music's mostly forgettable. The characters are, frankly, not very interesting. Like, they're not as clearly defined as the quote-unquote main six were in the Friendship is Magic series.
Is Magic had many years to develop those characters.
They figured their shit out in the first story arc. You watch the first story arc of Friendship is Magic, It's a little bit more action-oriented than the show would be, but everything is clearly there. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that in this movie. This movie's a little rushed. What can you do? But
it's new animation, too, so it's CG. And
I'm not in love with the style.
A lot of modern CG tends to crib from a similar style book. Yeah. And a lot of CG characters, even across many design disciplines, do tend to start looking a little samey after a while.
I was watching this with my partner, M. Lapis de Silva, and they said... they brought up something because they were an animation major in college, and they tend to notice things that I don't. And one thing they said, and I saw this, but I hadn't articulated it yet. One of the ways that they just made Sunny Star Scout seem like the protagonist was they gave her Elsa eyes. Oh. It's the same eyes as Elsa from Frozen. Yeah. They just gave her those eyes. Boom, boom.
They all have the same eyes. They have similar looking faces. Yeah. The way the eyebrows and the eyes dart about. All the animation is
a really little typical. Detail that I thought was lazy and frustrating is in the original My Little Pony, or rather, My Friendship is Magic. I don't really recall the original series. Ponies don't have hands. They can gesture with their hooves, and they can do some things.
Scoop things up in their hooves if they want to pick something up.
But if they actually want to manipulate something, say a pen or something, they have to use their mouths.
Oh.
And they do that constantly, and it's a sight gag. It's a fun gag that they repeatedly do. And there's a cute bit when the Equestria Girls bit where Twilight Sparkle becomes human, but she keeps wanting to use her mouth to do things. Yeah, it's kind of funny. So that's the gag. At some point in the intervening generations, I guess they developed opposable hooves. Because they're just using their hands for all kinds of shit.
We don't know how many millions of years have passed.
That's a fair question.
And they could have evolved.
It does raise the question of Princess Celestia and Princess Luna and Discord and a variety of other characters that we've met are immortal. And apparently have just let the entire country go to shit. And I'm kind of curious as to how that happened.
Well, do you remember what happened to Lestat in the vampire novels?
He went to sleep until hair metal was invented?
Well, Neil Jordan film, he lived so long, he just decided, immortality doesn't give way to motivation. So he just sort of sat still for a while and essentially turned into rock. He became a statue.
Well, that's not in the Neil Jordan film, that's actually in Queen of the Damned.
No, it's in the Neil Jordan film.
Louis
goes to visit him, and he's in this cave, and he's all made of, he's all stony. I remember that from the Neil Jordan film because I haven't seen Queen of the Damned.
I
know Aaliyah was a statue at one point to Queen of the Damned. I've seen the preview, but
no. I thought maybe I'm remembering Interview with the Vampire wrong. But they threw Louis's corpse to the crocodiles. I remember that, or the alligators, I guess. And then he just sort of popped up. He was just in a swamp for a really long ass time. That's what I remember. And then at Queen of the Damned, he just decided he was bored with humanity and decided to sleep for a few decades. But anyway, maybe I remember you're wrong.
Point being, maybe that's what's happening to these immortal pony beings. They just sort of became bored with ponydom and decided to sleep. And they're alive. They're still around.
Entirely antithetical to their personalities. You can't justify that.
You don't know how many millions of years have passed.
Again, this raises the question: what the fuck happened? And the movie does not answer that. And again, maybe they're going to do a series and they'll get into it, but it's fucking weird and it's a distracting question to ask when, again, this isn't the point, is that fascism is always looming. The point of Friendship is Magic, the show that they're trying to piggyback off of or ponyback off of, is again, utopianism. It's aspirational. And the worst thing that this movie does, aside from the sort of crash sort of approach to racism and storytelling, which is they say the people sort of paint all of this one people with a certain brush, all the earth ponies are like this, but then the movie ends up probably accidentally confirming that, the whole thing about earth ponies, they're the worst, and I'm like, I mean, they are the ones who become fascists and decide to commit genocide. So, I'm not sure your movie is having the best argument here.
I think this...
it's not the best argument, is my point. I'm not telling its argument very well.
I think it's telling its argument exceptionally well, because I'm not thinking of Friendship is Magic. I'm thinking of how they are telling a story about how the magic of friendship has somehow dissipated. I don't care how.
Okay.
It's just not in the world right now.
Yeah, we're approaching from a certain angle. I totally get that.
And the ponies are separated, and the thing that will unite them is getting to know one another. And that's a very simple message. You could say that's an oversimplified way of looking at racism, but this is a fable for children.
Agreed.
And I think that is a good way to look at it. I think that's a very healthy message. Mm-hmm. The idea that racism is looming and fascism is something people are eager to instill is actually a very healthy warning to put in a kid's film.
Yeah,
in fact, I was thinking of, if you remember, Cradle Will Rock. There's an element of that movie where the Cherry Jones character, she's the one in charge of the Works Progress Administration Theater Department, decides to greenlight a stage production of a play called Revolt of the Beavers. And it's for kids, and it's about a workers' uprising. It's about a fat, greedy beaver who runs a company and is exploiting his workers, and it's about how the workers essentially strike. And this isn't something that Depression-era America wanted on stage. This wasn't part of the arts. That was way too communist. So it became this sort of flashpoint in actual court cases between Cherry Jones, I forgot who played the congressman. I think it was Horace Yellen, I think was the actor. But about how, this lighthearted musical actually contained all of these, like, really hidden, actually not so hidden political messages, and they're trying to indoctrinate kids into communist ways of thinking, when really it was just about morally upstanding things.
Yeah, it's about, and in a vacuum, this is clearly morally upstanding.
Yeah, so this is one of those things where we can nitpick about how it's sort of maybe mishandling some of its politics, but really it's saying a lot of very healthy, morally upstanding things. I think the film overall is pretty bland.
I think the
animation isn't terribly exciting to look at.
It's pretty boring, actually.
Some of the color schemes are weirdly interesting, but
I think the
music, it doesn't really come off of this thing, but I think it is saying ultimately a very clear, very positive thing, and
you're gonna
give it a pass in my book.
No, that's fair enough, and I think it's important to note that we're coming at this from different angles. I'm someone who is more familiar with the context against which this is painted, and you're looking at it a bit more. I mean, you know a bit, but you're looking a bit more in a vacuum. And for me, what I've been thinking about while you've been talking about all of this is sort of the way that some people really, really dig, say, Star Trek Into Darkness.
Uh-huh.
And some people say,
That's
not really great Star Trek. And that actually kind of flies in the face of a lot of other Star Trek. And the way that this new narrative interacts with the old narrative that we are already familiar with is distracting. And I think that's kind of what it boils down to. Like, in a vacuum, if you know nothing about Star Trek and you only saw J.J. Abrams' Star Trek and then Star Trek Into Darkness, Star Trek Into Darkness is mostly fine. If you do know a lot about Star Trek, there's stuff in there that's really distracting, and you can tell when the movie deviates from the sort of the soul of the original.
Okay.
And that's what I'm getting at here. And that's why I'm not trying to be super harsh about this. I don't think it's a particularly good movie. I think the stuff that they change, ultimately, is just not as interesting as what came before. The message is relatively unassailable. I think they bungle the execution sometimes, but the overall message is fine. But the actual, like, story is more generic than this thing has been in a very, very long time. It doesn't really stand out, and it doesn't really make a place for itself, either by having really clever or witty writing, or by having really standout interesting characters, or by having really catchy fun songs, or even by looking particularly distinctive and interesting. It just becomes mediocre in a way that's very, very frustrating. And again, you can say it's relatively harmless, and maybe it is, but it's taking something that wasn't mediocre and rebooting it into something that is. And so I'm looking at that context, and I'm annoyed.
Anyway,
and that's all there is to it.
If you look at it on a broader timeline, it's still heads and shoulders above the original 1980s iteration.
I will agree with that. If we jumped right from that to this, I would say, like, wow, what a great improvement. But we know that there's some... But that would be like jumping right from, like, I don't know. That would be like...
There hasn't been a good version of, like, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe or anything.
No, well, if there is, I haven't been paying attention. I'm trying to think of, like, a good example of this, where it's like, we just skipped over the really good one, and we went to the one that's, like, okay. Like, you know, like, I'm trying to think, like, if we,
Dr. No is okay.
It would be like, imagine if we skipped over the Steven Summers G.I. Joe movie and went right to Snake Eyes. We would say, like, oh, that's a pretty good live-action G.I. Joe movie. They got some things wrong. Hmm. But, like, no, that doesn't even work out because that's not as good as Steven Summers. Anyway, I can't think of a good parallel. Right, but well, what is this? Meh. Moving on. Tell me about the new release, Sankofa.
Sankofa is actually not a new release. My screener for the Dan Stevens film I'm Your Man did not come through on time.
Oh.
Just some glitch, some miscommunication, somebody not sending it to the right address.
These things happen. Technical difficulties.
It's pretty common. I'm not blaming anybody. But no. That left me with sort of a gap as to what to see this week. Wouldn't you know it, Ava DuVernay's company found an Ethiopian film from 1993, directed by a man named Haile Gerima, and gave it a 4K restoration, restored the entire thing, and put it on Netflix with the usual amount of fanfare that these films on Netflix usually get.
Which is to say
almost none.
Yeah. Damn.
Yeah, so
I didn't hear about that.
This is a 1993 Ethiopian film that opened in, like, I think it was only in LA and New York back in 1993. It was self-distributed. It played for, like, maybe a week in a few art houses, and then it vanished, and it hasn't been available since. So, if you want to squint, you could say this is its proper release.
Okay.
This film begins on the coast of Ghana, if you look up where it takes place, there's a model, a young black woman is taking pictures in these fancy outfits, and there's all these tourists wandering around this castle. You look up the significance of this castle. This was a castle where essentially ships bound for America would pick up slaves.
Okay.
This was like the last stop on the way to the United States to be enslaved.
Yikes.
And they're just using it as a background for a photo shoot. Damn. This an old man approaches them and says, "You don't know the significance of this place. You're kind of defiling it in a way. You're not, you know, sort of understanding the history of this place and what is going on here." The model, let me look up the name of the actress. She wanders into a hallway, a cave within the castle, and she's immediately grabbed.
Oh no!
And she's grabbed, stripped, and branded, and Jesus. A bunch of slaves appear in that cave next to her, and all of a sudden she is a new character in the past.
Wow!
And she is now on a plantation in the United States somewhere. She's working for a family called the Lafayettes. And we get to meet her and all of the other slaves who worked on this plantation.
And does she retain her memories of the future?
No, she's like, she's played by the same actress, but she's kind of a new character.
Got it.
It's sort of like that movie Antebellum, but actually works and is thoughtful.
Okay. I'm about to say that is like the closest analog. Yeah,
the main character, Sankofa, is played by Kofi Ganaba is her name. She and all of these other slaves begin to sort of, we get to learn their relationships, how some of them are in love with others. He's like the overseer slave. He's the one who is tasked with beating the other slaves. And we get to sort of see the strain and hatreds and suffering and horrors of slavery from the perspective of the people who were living through it, and not in any kind of melodramatic way. It's actually a very naturalistic drama. A lot of the photography is very yellow and bright. A lot of it was shot during the magic hour. So there's a lot of sort of like light hanging in the air, and we get a sort of, a more human, more humane view of these characters, rather than using them as sort of
exploitation
stagey avatars for some sort of a faraway story. We're actually getting a much more immediate version of a slave story.
Got it.
And the dramas we see unfold in these very sort of humane ways, and the way these people speak to one another is really fascinating. What we're seeing here is, you might notice that each one of the characters that we're following around has a different accent. Because yeah. we're now actually sort of starting what is the African-American diaspora. Mm. How it was born of people kidnapped from many different places and forced together and sort of forming their own culture and trying to form their own morality beyond this like horrendous indignities that they've been suffering. We get to see a young man sort of fall off the deep end of extreme Christianity and how he becomes involved in the church, but that sort of gives him license to mistreat others. We get to see how mothers and daughters, how they start to come to blows over, you know, who gets to serve whom. All of these things are part of this bigger story. The movie's like 2 hours and 5 minutes, so we have plenty of time to sort of explore. When we finally understand the context of this story, which is bookended by the introduction. I mean, we've already understood this through watching the film, but the whole point of this is to say that these indignities and this horror and this horrendous part of history is still very much active. This isn't something that happened and ended. This is something that is still going on today. Hence the sort of like blending with the modern world. Remember this. This is part of a lot of storytelling and a lot of history and a lot of to use the word again, African diaspora that it's really kind of tapped into. And I apologize for using the crit word diaspora. I know that's can rub people the wrong way, but it's incredibly moving. This is maybe one of the more significant works I've seen about slavery.
Wow. Okay.
And about the slave experience. This is
an incredibly strong film. Thrown on Netflix and no one said anything.
This is a significant African film that maybe one of the better films of the 1990s. And wow. This is, just sort of being...
So this is an amazing motion picture.
This is a masterwork. This is something that I think people need to seek out.
Holy shit.
This is something they need to show in classrooms.
When did you see this?
2 days ago.
And you didn't, like, yell at me to make sure I saw it in time? Because this time I'm mad I missed this now.
No. I apologize.
Yeah. Don't wait.
I'll put it on the Twitters for what that's worth.
Well, I can't follow everything you do.
But yeah, Sankofa is a towering work that it really needs to be paid attention to. And once again, thanks to the nature of streaming, things can just sort of come and go really quickly. And if they're not being hyped by whatever platform they're going on to, or getting any kind of publicity whatsoever, it's just going to sort of be mixed in with this gigantic hunk of the word they use is content.
Yeah. All it is that they're just filling stuff up.
This is a significant work of art,
yeah,
and it needs to be paid attention to. So please, please go onto Netflix. Yeah. It's there.
All right. Well, I am definitely going to see that. I'm curious. Do you think it qualifies for your best movie of the year? Or do you think that this it's sort of like against? It's not like it's the other side of the wind where it was unavailable. Completely.
Other Side of the Wind wasn't even completed. It was never released. This one was technically released. So
an asterisk.
It's one of the best films of 1993. I can say that.
Fair enough.
Right there next to Super Mario Brothers.
Well, damn it. It sounds like I need to see that movie. The other movie that I saw this week was a British film called Surge, which we already made the cola jokes, so I think we're good. This is a film that stars Ben Whishaw, the voice of Paddington. He also plays Q in the new James Bond movies. He's a very good actor.
You ever see that movie Perfume?
No, but you told me about it a lot.
I love Perfume.
He's a very versatile actor. I'm a big, big fan. And this is a movie in which Ben Whishaw plays... he plays an airport security agent. It's, they don't have the TSA over there, but it's their equivalent. Mm. Every day, he goes to work... And he pats people down and he takes away insignificant trinkets because maybe they could be used as something bad. And he like violates people's dignity by having to like take them in to like be strip searched and stuff. And it's just a miserable, shitty, soul-sucking job. He's very isolated. He's very alone. It's his birthday and everyone's eating his cake, talking about how shitty the cake is, and nobody knows whose birthday it is. Like, that's, they, no one even brings it up. He goes and
then,
sees,
then Angelina Jolie shows up and she's a secret assassin.
God, I
and,
wish. Okay. No, he goes home to see his mom and dad. His dad is kind of an asshole. His mom has clearly lived with a lot of repression in her life, and finally, everything is just so shitty. Everything is so awful. He's just walking around. He's not even a zombie. He just looks dead. His eyes are sunken. Mm-hmm. And then he has this thing where he likes to bite things, like as a sort of a stress thing. Yeah. And he ends up biting his glass at his parents' house so hard that it shatters.
Oh, gosh.
And that's, for whatever reason, that's the thing that just makes him go, fuck it. So for the rest of the movie, he's living his life like, fuck it. He makes a scene at work. He completely calls attention to the fact that all they're doing is security theater and they're not actually it's not actually making people significantly any more secure. All they're doing is preventing people from like carrying their drink of water onto the plane. He gets
Bartleby the Scrivener
a little bit and
syndrome,
but it goes on from there and he just quits or he gets fired. Whether one of those happens, it's hard to say which. The girl he has a crush on at work was complaining that she was having trouble setting up her television. So he goes over to her house while she's sick to try to fix her TV. They need a cable to do it. He goes out to buy the cable. He doesn't have enough money for the cable because they only take cash. He's got to go to an ATM. The ATM takes his card. He goes to the bank. The bank refuses to like give him, he has to do it all online. They won't even give him any money. And he just says, fuck it. He writes a note and he robs the bank. And at this point, he's just completely living free of any of his old impressions, any of his old hangups, anything that's like preventing him from doing whatever he wants. What he wants is very rarely violent, but it's all very destructive. He like gets a hotel room and proceeds to just completely dismantle it. Like he carves up the bed just to like see if he could fit inside like a burrito. Like he breaks the TV. Like he's just.
But there's something cathartic about this.
There
kind
is.
Of narrative.
There is something cathartic about it. Like there's the my problem with the movie is that there's really nothing more to it than that. It's just he does this and it's kind of cathartic for him and like that's it. And on some level, I think we can all sympathize with that. Certainly, we've all had days like that where we wish we could just say, fuck it. I'm so sick and tired of this overwhelming weight that society has put on our shoulders to behave a certain way, work within certain parameters, live within certain parameters, become part of this capitalist system, live with all these Kafka-esque rules. And you just wanted to say, fuck it, I'm not following the rules anymore, I'm doing whatever. Joker is a movie about that in a lot of ways. And
the freedom that comes from madness, essentially.
Basically, Joker is a clunky movie. I'm not a big fan of Joker. I think there's a lot of things that are good about it. It's well photographed. Joaquin Phoenix is very good. But it's really clunky, and its connection to Batman is kind of awkward. But regardless, it has a point. It's an obvious point that I think it sells in a very adolescent way, but it does have a point. Surge just feels like, and then this happened, and then we're good. And there's something really frustrating about that, because it doesn't seem to have any particular thoughts about what this means, whether this is good, bad, it just simply is what it is. This is just watching Ben Whishaw kind of sadly cut loose for about an hour after the plot finally kicks in. Ben Whishaw is an incredible actor, and I think he's actually giving a really, really excellent performance here. I believe every single thing he's doing, which is, you know, hard to do when you're doing things that are self-destructive or quote-unquote mad. There's a really sweet scene towards the end where he actually finally has, like, a real conversation with his mom that I think is not quite enough to, like, give the movie a point or, like, a real purpose, but is probably the best scene in the movie. But yeah, it's just a movie that is angry and is demanding a catharsis. But I don't think the path to excess leads to the Palace of Wisdom here. I don't think the catharsis gets us anywhere. Well, it's not even all that cathartic, really. It's not even like he like starts a revolution or everyone's like inspired by him. He's just sort of sad and then it's over.
It's one of those like if you pay attention to the arc of a lot of like David Cronenberg movies, starts out in a very sort of like a sterile environment, and by the end somebody's in like a burnt out apartment, like
everything's been sort of infected, or inner chaos
has turned into outer chaos,
and here that's not really the case.
If it's a story of entropy, just about this guy's deterioration, that's also a line to follow.
It would be fine if it was entropy, but it's also arguing that he feels alive and free in a way that he never has, but it doesn't seem to be getting him anywhere or doing anything, and it just ends up feeling like a bunch of stuff that happened.
Freeing is getting somewhere
a little bit, but at this I don't want to ruin the ending, but the ending doesn't really make him feel that free. So I'm frustrated. This is a great performance wrapped in a premise for a movie, but it doesn't really feel like much of a film. So I guess if you like Ben Whishaw, and you should, he's a good actor, there's certainly the worst ways to spend a day than watching Surge. But yeah, this one didn't really do it for me. I had a rough week for movies. I did not see your instant classic 1993 movie. I saw a bad musical, a not very good musical, and Surge. So let's just wrap up this week.
Right.
Maybe next one will be better. Let's review movies on the critically acclaimed scale. How we review movies. We review movies on this podcast on a scale of C- to C+. Most movies, theoretically anyway, or average. They have some good and some bad. They're C. Movies that are below average in our estimation, movies we do not recommend, are C-. That's below average. And movies that we definitely recommend, we think they are at the very least above average, maybe even good or great, that's a C+. Surge, I'm going to give a very low C.
Okay.
Ben Whishaw's performance is good enough to pull it up. It's certainly made with some assurance, but I'm not ultimately convinced that it's going to have any meaningful impact other than, Ben Whishaw's good, isn't he? So that's where I'm at. What about Sankofa?
Sankofa, definitely a C+. Okay. Really, really good. Good performances across the board. I apologize, I mixed up some of the actors' names.
Oh, yeah.
The main character is played by Oyafunmike Ogunlano, is the main actress's name.
Okay.
And she's really great. Kofi Gabbana is like a divine drummer character. He's sort of like the one who's keeping the stories connected.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really exhilarating. It's really just a wonderful discovery. I love when I stumble upon a film like this. Oh, wait. These classics still exist.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily remembered.
Thanks to Avedur Vinay, we have access to it. You wouldn't know it.
Yeah,
but yeah, but it's there. It's right there. Go on Netflix. It. So yeah, if you have a Netflix subscription, just tune in.
My Little Pony: A New Generation is harmless, or at least mostly harmless. But I don't think its execution is really good enough for me to recommend. Again, if you want to show it to little kids, they won't be worse off for it. But I also don't think they're going to be particularly inspired, enchanted. I just think they're just going to get a pretty okay message and a pretty bland movie. So I'm giving it a high C-. I just don't think it's worth recommending. But it's also not painful. It's just is what it is. They took something really interesting and they made something kind of generic.
I agree with you that it is kind of generic, but I'm going to give it a C because I think it does have some very positive things to say and a lot of very modern things to say about the way prejudice operates and how insidious it is and how it can even exist in the pony world.
Yeah, it's a good message. Yeah, I don't think it's told very well.
Is it subtle or nuanced? No, but this is a movie about pony people, so I'm going to be very forgiving, and I'm going to give it a C.
All right, and then finally, Dear Evan Hansen.
This is a big old C-. This is just a big oily blot where they... had a lot of high ambitions. You can't really make a truly bad film unless you try to aim real high. This one aims high. A
lot of ambition.
Like, splatters a few targets here and there, but doesn't actually hit anything significant.
Yeah.
Ultimately, just giving us this really unsatisfying, kind of awkward non-morality fable that doesn't really have anything significant or human or moral to say about its scenario.
The movie I'm going to compare Dear Evan Hansen to, and I give it a big old C- as well, is a movie that we don't talk about very often because it's not good. But Passengers, starring Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence, a movie that is a horror movie, but seems completely oblivious to that fact.
Oh, where That's a science fiction movie about passengers on this it's like a century long spaceship trip.
Everyone's cryogenically frozen, basically, and then one person is accidentally woken up many decades too soon. Like, and he will die of old age before they get to their destination.
And for many years, he sort of tools around this gigantic ship by himself. He realizes that he's lonely and decides to, the decision is to open another pod, essentially dooming somebody else to the same fate, so he has some company.
And then he pretends that that's not what he did in order to get her on his side so that he can romance her. And the movie is completely on his side, even though I'm sympathetic with why he did it. Who can blame him for tempted? But the thing that he did is monstrous. And from her perspective, this is a horror movie about being trapped in a place a stalker,
literally held hostage.
She cannot escape from. And it's really twisted.
The way they lay it out in that movie is she finds out the truth, because inevitably she's going to. That's not a spoiler. And then a gigantic crisis occurs all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And so they're so busy surviving that they don't actually get a chance to really think or have any kind of meaningful discussions about it.
Yeah.
And through that crisis, evidently they are able to make up. And that's the story of that
movie.
And that's
an irresponsible way to treat that kind of like emotional manipulation and abuse. And I think Dear Evan Hansen is kind of like that. I think they had this big idea of how this story would play and how they're going to hit all these big notes. And we're going to tell this really, sort of complicated story about someone who's going through a lot and makes a difficult decision that is bad. But then they don't know how to handle the follow through. And as a result, all of my sympathy is for the people Evan Hansen hurts. Uh-huh. And I have very little left for Evan Hansen, even though in a vacuum, yes, I understand what he's going through and it's very sad. So I think they weren't trying to make a horror movie, but so much of this movie plays like one because of how much he's hurting people, even people who aren't alive anymore. And the movie just doesn't seem to want to be willing to engage with that. And that's this weird level of detachment from the filmmakers and the story that they're telling that infects the entire movie. And even if things are good about it, they're just trapped under the weight of all that. And yeah, this movie does not work for me at all. And that is critically acclaimed.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you very much. We'll be back next week with more movie reviews like you do. Venom 2 is coming out.
That's right. Venom, colon. Yeah.
Let there be Carnage. Which is a story about Carnegie Mellon, the university, and then that time Venom went there to speak.
I think it was IGN had a fun, you don't know Jack game with the director and the lead actor. Is this a Venom symbiote or is it a heavy metal band? Because there's a lot of Venom spin-off characters
in the comics.
So it's,
That's cute.
And Venom is the name of a band as well.
It is. Yeah, that's a good point. Works out well. But anyway, we're talking about that and a bunch of other things as well. Thank you for listening. If you haven't subscribed already, please do. We have a lot of other shows here. We have Critically Acclaimed every week. We've Got Mail. We answer your emails. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box. Those are interested. Whitney, what's our P.O. box?
Our P.O. box is Critically Acclaimed Network 6.
P.O.
box 641565, Los Angeles, California 90064. Send us a physical letter. We like getting those.
Yep. We also have our show Canceled Too Soon, Critically Reclaimed, which you can vote on. What movie we watch every week. At their Critically Acclaimed Patreon. Our Patreon is patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows, some of which we talked about today. All Our Yesterdays, our show where we review every single episode of Star Trek. Holy Batman, we're reviewing every 1960s Batman episode. We got shows about the Oscars. We got commentary tracks. The whole galore. And thank you, everybody who is listening, who is a patron. Without you, we would not be here. And I wouldn't know what to do with my time. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful to you. Thank you so much. And of course, we're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at Lynn Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
I also run a soap store with my partner, M. Lapis Da Silva. It's on Etsy. It's also on social media. Look us up at Salt Cat Soap. We sell designer soaps, and we've started coming up with some cool stuff for the holidays. I designed a candy corn soap, which smells of buttercream and looks just like a big old piece of candy corn, and it's really nice. We've also crafted glow-in-the-dark soaps that look like ghosts. And those have been selling like hotcakes. We cannot keep those in stock.
Glow-in-the-dark hotcakes.
If you follow we made a whole new batch, and we sold out in about 10 minutes.
Hey,
as soon as we announced it. So, like, people are liking them, and they're... So, if you want some of those, please follow our social media account. We're going to make an announcement of when they're going to come back in stock, so people can actually be ready for it. A lot of people were like, oh, I didn't know, and I missed my chance. So, follow us at Salt Cat Soap on Instagram or Twitter or on Facebook, and we will make an announcement about when those will be ready. But we also have pumpkin soaps that are coming into the store later this week, and some other cool stuff as well. Nevermore soap, a Edgar Allan Poe inspired soap coming as well for the holidays. So again, thank you everybody for listening. You're really, really awesome. And we will see you next time. And until then, never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?